Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Yes, let's do a show. Speaking of,
yes,
crying our eyes out.
Your last show.
Hello, everyone. I'm Molly Wood. Welcome back to Make Me Smart, where we make today make sense. Thank you for joining us. I'm not crying already. I'm going out with a wicked head cold. It's not COVID, although we do have apparently Omicron in San Francisco right across the bay. So I guess you never know. It's not funny.
I mean, I guess that's kind of coming full circle from starting the daily.
I know, right?
Way.
Good point.
Yeah. Well, I'm Kimberly Adams. This is What Do You Want to Know Wednesday? And that means it is time for us to answer listener questions. If you have a question that you'd like us to answer in a future episode, you can send it our way. We're at makemesmart@marketplace.org. You can call us or leave us a voicemail. Our number is 508-827-6278. That's 508-UB-SMART.
Yeah. All right, let's rock it. Last week, Kimberly and Kai did a deep dive about the Federal Reserve, and we got this not insubstantial question.
Hi, my name is Carlos, and I live in Miami, Florida, very sunny Miami, Florida. My question is, why do some people want to abolish the Fed? Thank you.
Right? No big deal.
So,
why don't we just get rid of that, Kimberly?
Yeah, just like, what would happen? Forget all this whole, what are interest rates going to be and who gets to decide? Like, leave it. Well, there are varying reasons across the political spectrum why people want to get rid of the Fed. You know, as we talked about in the deep dive, some people say that it really contributes to economic inequality and widening the wealth gap, and that it just helps the way that the Fed uses its tools to maneuver the economy. Allows rich people to get richer and kind of puts additional barriers in the way of lower income folks from moving up the economic ladder. That tends to be the argument that you'll hear from folks on the left who want to eliminate the Fed. On the right, you get people like Ron Paul, who we mentioned, who really want to get rid of it because it's another sign of big government and too much government intervention, and the idea that the Federal Reserve needs to step back and leave it to free market capitalism. Ron Paul also wants to go back to the gold standard, which basically every economist you're going to talk to is going to say is a terrible, terrible idea. But it kind of fits in with this. We don't want the federal government intervening in what businesses and local communities are trying to do. And a group of people sitting in Washington making these decisions that influence the entirety of the U.S. economy is, in their opinion, a bad idea. So those are some of the arguments.
And banks, to be clear, right? Because there's also this argument that sort of, it's a corollary to the Ron Paul argument, the sort of libertarian idea of not so much big government, but also like with a dash of Occupy Wall Street, right? The idea that the Fed's primary constituent is supposed to be the, you know, economic health of the American people, but that in fact it's basically a cartel of banks, which is yet another one of the criticisms of
it. They do have the different Federal Reserve banks of. I mean, it is a group of banks. I'm sure that they don't like being called a cartel.
I mean, I didn't say it. I just read it.
I know.
It on
I mean, it is fun. I'd never heard that before. That's kind of funny.
It's like kind of go down a weird Federal Reserve rabbit hole when you read about what, you know, people like there seem to be legitimate after the fact, you know, determination that the Fed exacerbated the Great Depression in the 20s by tightening monetary supply. That may have been at the direction of the president in part, but that also that was, you know, big people make the argument that like maybe the Fed doesn't work.
Yeah, and people have made the argument that the Fed made the recovery from the Great Recession take longer by, you know, raising interest rates too quickly and stuff.
And fueled the bubble in the first place with low interest rates. It seems like the Fed might get blamed no matter what. But I mean, I think it's, you know,
basically
lots
yeah.
of reasonable questions to ask, although it seems like the consensus is that, flawed though it may occasionally be, the Fed is not going anywhere.
Yeah, probably not. Okay, our next question comes from Lee in New Jersey. They ask, I looked into replacing my gas appliances with electric, but stoves seem to require a 220-volt line, of which I have none in my house. Surely this affects the economics of switching from gas to electric. Can you address this? Molly, this is all you.
It definitely does. I like this is, again, also very... First, we have the huge 10,000-foot question, and then they're like, what about the 220? This is true. Like... If you are switching from a gas stove to an electric or inductive range, you will need to plug the stove into a 220-volt electrical outlet. A lot of people upgrade their electrical to 220 when they get an electric car also. Mm. Both of those involve an electrician and can cost you between $350 and $1,000, depending on where you live. The cost of capping the gas line is another $350. And electric stovetops, plain electric, is, you know, about the same price as gas, maybe even a little cheaper. Inductive ranges, which, you know, heat through induction and are super pimp. Like, they heat up and cool down super fast and are as responsive as gas, which is part of the reason that people like them, are very expensive, like $1,500 minimum expensive. Yeah, so, and I'm not trying to be a buzzkill. What I'm trying to say is that this is why, in some cases, incentives are going to be required if we want people to switch to electric in their homes. New homes need to be built with 220 already. A lot of them are being built, you know, some states are passing laws that say you can't build new housing developments that have gas hookups at all. But I think, you know, the idea of rebates and incentives that worked with energy consumption, you know, what is the energy standard that I'm thinking of? The one that came out of Cal, you know, the one that's like plastered on anything, everything that's like, this
like
is a really
green
efficient
building or the
refrigerator.
LEED
certified for buildings, but also even just the like, we don't even think of it anymore because it's just on every fridge.
It's like the little leaf and the little scale says how efficient it is.
Exactly. So those are the things. I'm sure Bridget's like already got it. We just need to look at that.
I know. She's I'm opening up Slack right now. Like, I'm sure.
I know. Help. Anyway, it worked with energy efficiency in terms of marketing and rebates and incentives, but that is what it's going to take because it will be expensive for people to make some of these switches. Some counties are already starting to do it. Marin County offers $500 to single family property owners who switch from gas to electrical, but that's in California. And that's actually not even like $500 isn't going to cut it, you know? So it's going to have to get more aggressive, but also hopefully prices will come down as like you know, what rich people do tends to trickle down to the masses. Like, early adopters are what make new technologies more affordable. So it's going to be
And this is what you've really been getting
curve.
Into at your in your podcast. It's like it's going to take all of these small changes plus the really big ones to do what needs to happen in order to mitigate climate change. Here's somebody who wrote in and is trying to do something better for the climate, but there's this cost barrier. And every single one of these little pain points kind of have to be addressed if we're going to fix this.
Yep,
or at
absolutely.
Least, not fix it. It's probably too late to fix it, but you know what I mean.
Survive, I believe. I believe
survive.
How we survive. Yes.
How we survive. Next up, we have a voicemail from Greg in Torrance, California. He asks,
can you make me smart about stadium naming rights? So the Staples Center here in LA is soon going to become the Crypto.com Center for the next 20 years. But our local soccer stadium is the Home Depot. No, it is the StubHub. No, it is the Dignity Health Center, which has gone through 3 name changes in the past 15 years. Many thanks. Love the show.
I feel like since you're the California person, I should let you start with this one.
because we have to live with crypto.com. Yeah, thanks.
Yes,
thanks.
Basically. You're
I'm pretty sure actually that the stadium where the San Francisco Giants baseball team plays in San Francisco, I believe is officially known as AT&T Stadium, but like we all still call it Peck Bell. So first of all, there's the actual deals. Then there's what people are willing to say anymore. Mm. I mean, naming rights for stadiums has a long history, of course. It started sort of around the 90s. And, you know, of course, it's like great advertising and exposure and brand trust and like, ooh, I'm a new company or a new thing like crypto. And I want everybody to say it over and over and over until it becomes totally normalized. But in terms of the, first of all, the crypto.com thing, in case you missed this, crypto.com recently bought the naming rights to the downtown Los Angeles arena, currently known as the Staples Center, a pretty famous one. It's a 20-year deal, reportedly worth $700 million. But to the kind of, I think, the thrust of this question, which is like, wait, does a 20-year deal really mean a 20-year deal? Staples also had originally a 20-year deal worth $116 million. Halfway through that contract, it agreed to lifetime naming rights with the stadium.
Lifetime.
But clearly, now it's not Staples. It's crypto.com. No. So to find out how that happened, our intrepid producers called the Staples Center VP of AEG Staples Center VP of Communications, Michael Roth.
In January of 2019, we were able to successfully make a deal with Staples to buy back the naming rights. And at that point, we were able to go out back to market. And if we could resell them, then we were entitled to do that. And we would be able to switch the name.
So you have to imagine
the rights from Staples.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have to imagine they made that deal very much worth Staples' interests in it.
Since Staples isn't selling a lot of staples these days, I bet they were happy to get that cash, yes.
Yeah, I'll bet they were too. And I mean, what
contracts
your point earlier. Yeah. Your point earlier about how, you know, just getting somebody to say something over and over again can lend authority and validity and maybe even embed you better into a community is a good one. So if your local sportscasters or your national sportscasters are saying this over and over again and it's on your ticket and it's on the branding and it's on the team bus or whatever, I guess it wouldn't be on the bus.
Yeah.
It's on the stadium. It's in all the pictures. So I think, you know, especially for something like crypto, which is trying to become more mainstream, that this makes a lot of sense, I guess.
Yeah,
get it.
It does. I mean, it does make it seem, you know, more like the more times you hear it, the more legit it's going to sound. Maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Our last question comes
from.
We've
had Bush Stadium in St. Louis forever. I don't think they're going to ever let that go.
No,
and nor
should
they.
Out of
Anheuser Busch's cold dead hands.
Seriously. All right, our last question comes from Shannon in Tucker, Georgia.
Since Molly is leaving, and since we are staring down the barrel of the continued great resignation, I want to know about the history of 2 weeks' notice. Why do people give 2 weeks' notice? And the second part of the question would be, is anyone doing it anymore? Thanks for answering the question, Molly. We will miss you very much, and best wishes in the future.
Oh, thanks, Shannon.
Well, thanks for giving us more than 2 weeks' notice, Molly. Because
a long goodbye, like stinky fish around here.
No, nice smelling fish, the kind that even Kai would allow us to microwave in the office.
Would he though?
No, he wouldn't. So, I mean, people give 2 weeks' notice to be polite. Unlike the history of the origins of the 40-hour work week, we really don't know where 2 weeks' notice started exactly. And it's a courtesy. It's not the law. You don't have to do it unless you have a contract that forces you to. And as Molly just said, some contracts have wiggle room. But most employees in America, including me, are an at-will employee. You're in an at-will relationship with your boss, which means you can be fired at any point without getting any advance notice. But most experts think that this 2-week notice on the employee side started sometime in the 40s or 50s at least. And that's when a lot of these big companies, that's when a lot of these big companies started formalizing their HR practices and putting it into handbooks. And it just kind of stuck. But then more recently, especially among younger workers, people are just like, why are we doing this? Because especially during the recession, when people were just getting fired or laid off with no notice, they were like, why are we going to give our employers notice when they don't give us any notice? Megan McCarty-Carino did a story on this a while back, which we'll have a link to it in the show notes. And it really goes through a lot of this, which is pretty interesting.
That's so fascinating that we have a social contract that basically says employees will be nice to you on the way out the door. Mm-hmm. Even, granted, when people are leaving in a real rage, maybe not.
Yeah.
But still, yeah. Most of the time that people are leaving a job, there's dissatisfaction involved. And it's surprising that then it's the expectation that the employee will be like, but I'll ease the transition for you. Now, granted, you get paid a little longer. So if you don't already have a new job, I guess that's useful in terms of those 2 weeks. But it is not necessarily reciprocal. It's true.
And it's also worth noting that especially right now with such a tight labor market and people just job hopping all over the place, a lot of people aren't giving notice anymore. And it can put employers in a bind when they suddenly have, an empty seat to fill.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
speaking of which,
we've put it off long enough. Exactly. On that note, that is it for us today. That is it for me. Today is my last day on Make Me Smart. It was one full month's notice, I'll have you know. And here at Marketplace, out of respect for my colleagues and this wonderful audience, we wanted to give you lots of time to prepare yourselves for this day. Thank you for listening. And thank you for giving me and Marketplace this one incredible gift on the way out, which is that we crushed the Giving Tuesday goal. Crushed it.
Crushed it.
Raised over $130,000 in one day. And let me remind you, because I'm taking every chance I can at Public Radio Gold, it was a dollar for dollar challenge. So you successfully unlocked the Marketplace Investors Challenge Fund. If I could give you a tote bag, I would.
Achievement unlocked.
If you still want to give, there are, I believe, a couple of pairs of banana pants left. Marketplace.org/givesmart. Just saying.
Yes.
They're the best.
We'll always have the banana pants, Molly.
We will always have the banana pants. I have 3 pairs, and I'm never giving them up. Except to my kid. I got one special for. I donated the full amount, you should know, just so I could get one pair for my kid. I'll be supporting you from afar.
I'm going to miss you, Molly. Not that we won't still be Zooming cocktails, but still.
Exactly. We'll be Zooming cocktails, and I will be listening. And to all of our listeners and friends, thanks for a great ride. You're the best. I will see you all on the internet.
Make Me Smart, and I will be back tomorrow to host Hollowed Out Shell of a Thursday, which will be particularly hollowed out with Molly gone. In the meantime, keep sending your questions. We're at makemesmart@marketplace.org or leave us a voicemail. Our number is 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UB-SMART.
Such a good song.
Today's episode of Make Me Smart was produced by Marissa Cabrera and Marque Green. It was engineered by Liana Squalachi. Our intern is Grace Rubin.
Ben Holiday and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music oh so long ago, and our senior producer is the one and only Bridget Bodner. Best in the biz. Damn. This is feeling a little real right now. Not gonna lie.
It is a little real. But awesome things ahead, yeah?
Exactly. It's going to be great.
You got this.
We've all got this. We've all got this.
We've all got this. And now I have tears.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.